Welcome to the Shelf Shedding Movie Show. I'm your host, Jason Dubray, and I am so excited about this episode. We are officially looking at underrated 1970s movies, and we're looking at two movies, but there is a third because of this really interesting trend in the last few episodes when I've had Carmelita Valdez-McCoy as a guest, and so we'll talk about that one probably first off. But we also have Matt Bledsoe of Film Feast, a show that I listen to religiously. It is one of my comfort podcasts when I go to work Monday morning. I'm not feeling motivated. I am listening to it and just brings out a joy of the movies that I can't quite articulate. And I've actually been inspired with my show in some of the ways that, like, it's almost like a hangout type of a really cool podcast that you have, but it's just a joy. Anyway, among my favorite episodes are when Carmelita and Matt are together. You know, probably the one I'm going to mention, which was catalyst for the idea, because it's been mentioned so many times on Film Feast. But when the two of you talked about Crash, that was amazing, because Matt, you were giggling through the whole thing and talking about awkward sex scenes, which are not sexy at all. For those who haven't seen that movie, it has been reviewed on this podcast. And then I just enjoy every other time. Most recently, I'm a few weeks, or I don't even, at this point, it might be a few months behind, because Matt, you put out a lot of episodes about once a week there for 3 years. Yeah. Between you and Lindsay, the hardest working podcasters in show business ever. But I recently listened to your Pulp Fiction episode and loved that as well. Yeah, that's one where I was wanting to talk back. It was like, oh, but what about that? What about that? So anyway, long introduction, but welcome to the show to talk about the 1970s, and then one 1960s movie to throw into to muddy the waters a little bit. So welcome back.
I don't want to cut in front of Carmelita, but hello. Yeah. Thank you for having us back on.
Welcome back. This is the third time that you've been on, Matt. And Carmelita, I've lost count how many times.
How it is with Carmelita on Film Face. I don't even know. I think I've podcasted with Carmelita more than anybody at this point. I haven't counted. But I'd be curious. I have to go count. I'm really curious now. Like, it's got to be you or Daniel are up there, I'm sure. Daniel Epler. I can't imagine anyone else even being close, maybe. I love podcasts, Carmelita. It's always so much fun. Brings out the best in me. makes me uncomfortable. The Crash conversation is like legendary at this point, because it was just
Film Feast really something. Legend.
That's in the Hall of Fame Film Feast episode.
What to me would be the greatest thing is playing that episode for David Cronenberg and watching his reaction and probably his joy at hearing.
Probably the love direction that.
The conversation went.
It's like, it worked. I did it.
I would die. I would die. I would love that.
Well, thank you for all the nice things you said too. That I really appreciate that. That people want to listen to me talk about movies is insane to me still. And it's nice that we're a comfort show. I love hearing that. I mean, coming out Mondays, I think, is a big deal. People have mentioned, like, people like it on Mondays. It's like a good way to start your week off. So I appreciate that. Okay. So that was very nice of you. So
I wish I was organized to have a consistent day where my show comes out. Originally, I was following my buddy's format every 2 weeks. And I think I chose Tuesdays. But then life would get in the way and things would get tough. And I'd be, like, stressing myself out to get something edited. I think Carmelita, I even talked to you about it at one point. It's like, put out the episodes when you can put out the episodes. And, you know, yep. A lot of people listen to them, you know, or discover it later on and go back to older episodes anyway. So it doesn't necessarily matter. But yeah, the discipline, Matt, that you have to do that is impressive. So,
well, thank you.
It's always a joy. And so I'm curious about where this is going to go, because we have three varied movies here. But before we can get into that, just the general topic of the 1970s, I was fortunate, just again, my own bias is that my two favorite decades are the 70s and the 90s. So I'm really happy that just barely I am a child that was born in the 1970s, because I think it was a really interesting time. I don't know, though, as I feel like some of the things we've gone through, some things that were like the 1960s and still are, and some moments that are kind of like the 70s. And as an adult, that hasn't been as much fun as it was looking back and seeing, whoa, look at all the cool fashion and different things that were going on in the 60s and 70s, because like the politics and the upheaval and energy crises and these different things were not a lot of fun, but great for cinema. I mean, there was really this edge and this, I think, cynicism and anger that kind of permeated the whole decade. So what does 70s cinema, I guess, mean for each of you? Carmelita, if you want to go first.
So, you know, growing up in the 80s and watching a lot of films with my father, my parents, but more specifically my father, watched a lot of 70s movies. And I mean, ever since I was a little kid, The Godfather is my favorite movie. So saw it very young. We saw a lot of 70s movies very young. And there is something about that decade where filmmakers, it's like, we're out of the studio system. You know, we're not having to deal with all of the real tight restrictions of the Hays Code. Filmmakers are taking risks. They're telling challenging stories. Actors, you know, coming out of all the actor studio folks from the 50s and 60s, it's like there's all these new ways for actors to interpret their roles and perform them. It's just like an amazing decade in cinema. And it's been like a lifelong love of mine. I still watch a lot of 70s movies, and there's still so many for me to see. So I'm always love it when people give me recommendations. And I had not seen one of the films that we're going to talk about. Yeah. So that was an interesting experience. It's just, yeah, it's a great decade. I think we wouldn't have the 80s and the 90s films that we know and love if we hadn't had filmmakers breaking the mold in the 70s. So mm-hmm. We can all be grateful for that.
And that's when Quentin Tarantino, and I know it's a controversial topic sometimes for you, Carmelita, but that's when he was a little boy going with his mom and stepfathers or boyfriends or whatever, and that shaped his film tastes, which then led to what he did in the 90s, which, I mean, very much as you said in that episode, I recommend people listen to it, changed cinema as we know it. So it's interesting that evolution, 70s, 20-year cycles to what happened in the 90s to where we are now. Matt, what about you? What are your thoughts on 70s cinema?
Well, that was so well said. I'm going to follow that. But I mean, it's probably, a lot of people I've heard say it's the best decade for movies, which, I mean, you could definitely make a case for it. I guess it depends on taste, but it feels like the most free decade for movies. Like, it's like people were doing whatever they wanted for the most part. And like America specifically is in a weird place. It's post-Vietnam. And I always think of it kind of as like a downer decade for movies. Like until the end, I feel like, I think maybe I wasn't alive. I wasn't there, but I've heard people say that by the end of the decade, people were like a little weary of like, okay, God, everything's so depressing. Like, and then Star Wars comes out and Jaws and these kind of big blockbuster type movies, people will start gravitating towards those, which leads into the 80s. But like, it's a great decade for movies. And I was thinking outside of just America, like in you've got Italian, like horror movies coming out, all crime movies. Yeah. And you've got, yes. I was watching Hong Kong stuff recently from the 70s, like Shaw Brothers stuff that they were doing, yes. Then. So like, there's all kinds of cool stuff going on in the 70s. It's one of the best. And it's funny you said 70s and 90s. I feel like they kind of mirror each other. Like, because post 80s and then Tarantino comes, like a Tarantino and all these, yeah. Other people like kind of start that off again, which goes until kind of the end of the decade, because like Paul Thomas Anderson and mm-hmm. like David O. Russell and these other people come up like and get to make their movies, and they feel very like independent, auteur driven. Like, so I, you know, it's a great decade, very interesting. A lot of stuff where you could feel people were really upset with things in the country, like in the movies, which is always interesting to look back on. I love the 70s for movies. It's almost my favorite decade, but it's one of my favorite decades because it's just, yeah. There's so much good stuff in that 10-year span. It's crazy.
Yeah, I really struggle between the 70s and the 90s as my favorite. Because sometimes I'll say the 90s, and that's because when I became a full-on movie geek and I was wanting to see everything, and you never see everything because you see kind of what was at the video store and what was mainstream, or even the independent, the crying games and the pianos and, you know, definitely Pulp Fictions and those were kind of mainstream in a way. They were the, you know, the super successful independent films that, unfortunately, the Weinsteins and people like that were kind of putting forward. But there were all of these other really amazing movies that were happening. I'm still discovering, and I'm like, I watched a lot of movies in the 90s, and there's still lots to discover. For me, the 70s was because I started to discover it, and they felt like old but not too old movies to me. They weren't like, you know, until I got into noirs and black and white films, they were like, oh, this is in color, and yeah, sure, it looks a little bit grainy, and they take a lot more time than 90s movies, and definitely compared to now. Longer movies, instead of you get out of the car and cut to the next location, we watch the person shut the door, and then walk to the other side of the car, get the keys, go up to the door, open the door, and like every single action is captured on film. You know, and there's something I find comforting and charming about that. It, you know, some people find that that's a little bit, they get a little impatient with that, and like, okay, let's move it along with 70s movies, and that can happen sometimes too. But very interesting, and this is, again, and I view this is a fresh episode, because all three of these movies, I think, feel like two of the three I should have seen by now, but I had not, and one was it complete, and you know, spoilers for later on, wonderful discovery. So so we'll maybe go into it, but going back to this, traces back a few episodes ago where we talked about Elizabeth Taylor and our Hagsploitation episode. And then I had mentioned I hadn't seen Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte. And so that became part of our next episode. And then it was brought up, I hadn't seen Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And as often happens, and will probably end up happening at the end of this episode, the movie that gets the least number of points is one I don't have a physical copy of. And so then you said for your next episode, you have to have watched Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Sister, sister, oh so fair, why is there blood all over your hair?
Whatever happened to Baby Jane? To seek the answer to that question, we will follow a man plotting a murder. Highly specialized work. But Robert Aldrich has considerable experience in such matters. He has a dozen successful pictures to his credit. His stars are Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. The scene, an Italianate villa in a once fashionable section of Los Angeles. Its halls, once crowded with the bright, the beautiful, and the celebrated, now echo only to hectic whispers, the insistent call of a buzzer better left unanswered. A telephone that has become an object of fear. A supper tray that will not be touched. A window barred against the world. A hammer. A mute scrawl crying for help. From these elements, director Aldrich has fashioned a motion picture with a curious title. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? Betty Davis is Jane Hudson. Joan Crawford is Blanche Hudson. But we must warn you, if you're long-standing fans of Miss Davis and Miss Crawford, this motion picture is quite unlike anything they have ever done. It is a bold essay in the art of the macabre. A venture to the ultimate reaches of terror. A motion picture definitely not for the squeamish. And we beg you, as the tension builds to the screaming point, as shock after shock assaults your senses, try to remember that this is only a motion picture. Try and remember.
Get away from me! Get away from me!
No, we can't show you anymore. Only when you see Whatever Happened to Baby Jane will you know. And the answer is total suspense.
I was hard on Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, I would say, in that episode. I kind of thought, I could see where this could go and what this could be. I'm happy to report that whatever happened to Baby Jane was not a huge punishment for me. It was actually a pleasure. So, director Robert Aldrich, and after watching this, and I'm only a few episodes in, I was like, I have to watch that Ryan Murphy series Feud find out more and more about the backdrop of this film, and of course Hush Hush, and that stuff is so fascinating. But this movie is awesome as well. Is it a perfect movie? I would say not, but there's a lot to like, and some of the bigger elements I think make sense in a way, you know. So for those who are not familiar with it, I would call it a horror movie. I think this was perhaps a pioneer in the sense that now A-list or previously A-list actors would become comfortable acting in horror movies. It wasn't some niche thing. It wasn't a midnight movie thing for creature feature for kids who are, you know, getting drunk and making out of the drug. You're going to have Joan Crawford and you're going to have Betty Davis in a horror movie. And this is about two aging sisters. One is a former child star, Baby Jane, played by Betty Davis. Her wheelchair bound sister Blanche, played by Joan Crawford, who was this, again, big star in Hollywood until it appears that Baby Jane decided to drive her into the fence going into their house and has kept her in a wheelchair. And we're watching their lives in this mansion, which is falling apart. This really unhealthy relationship where it appears that Baby Jane is keeping her sister hostage on the second floor of the mansion and not letting her see anybody and be cut off from the world. And a lot of jealousy, manipulation, and some pretty colorful performances, most especially by Ms. Davis. That's where I think, because we have the caveat in the first scenes that she was, and I really do think that they're playing on Shirley Temple here, that like she's this Shirley Temple-like performer, and I think it was 1917 in the opening sequence or something like that. Spoiled brat of a child star, and Baby Jane, she never really loses this as she becomes an older woman. So the fact that this performance is so big, and the costume is outrageous, and the makeup is outrageous, I think it makes a little bit more sense than in Hush Hush, where this was so over the top. I know there are reasons behind that for sure. So I can get behind that. I still, ultimately, if it's an head-to-head acting battle, despite how horrible they were to each other on the making of this, I prefer Joan Crawford's performance. I just think having to react to that and being a little bit more subtle, and some of the, you know, mobility and physical challenges with the role, and how she tries to kind of figure out different escape plans is great. It's kind of like, in a way, I kept thinking of Misery when I watched this, and I'm sure Stephen King watched this and in creating the novel, and certainly Rob Reiner would have in putting that great film together. I always go back to, I love Kathy Bates in it, but James Caan is so good in Misery, and he is the less flashy role, and I think Joan Crawford's in that situation. Whether all of the stuff that happens in the third act of the film is completely plausible, it's still entertaining. I highly recommend it for people. So thank you very much for making me at long last watch this movie. And, you know, it's, again, it was probably the most enjoyable of any of the ends of my episodes, as far as losing a movie or having to watch something else. So really enjoyed it. But I like to hear both of your thoughts on this this classic film. I mean, it's remembered 60 some years later. So, yeah.
I would love to hear what Matt has to say about it.
Yeah.
I thought you would. This movie is cuckoo bananas. Like, it is.
Now, had you ever seen this?
No, never seen it.
The first time.
I love this. I love it.
Been on my watch list forever. Nice. was always near the top because, like, I'd sort it different ways and all, you know, it's like, it's a highly rated movie seen by a lot of people. And it was like, I got to see that movie. It's always up near the top. I just never got around to it. You guys finally pushed me to watch it for this. And I did really enjoy it, even though I mentioned you before, it took like 3 days to watch it, which probably hurt a little bit, but I still really enjoyed it. And I was like, this is so crazy and so mean. I could not believe for 1962. I know there was many movies made, but it's like with two pretty big stars. I know they were like not at the time at their peak, but just like how nasty it was. And Bette Davis's performance is like out of this world. like it looks like someone loaded up a paintball gun with makeup and just fired it at her face. Like, it's just so, it's so crazy. But it was, I think Carmelita might have froze. Sorry. Oh, there she is. Okay, I got scared. I thought we lost you, Carmelita. But it's like, I mean, it's funny too. This came up on Film Feast recently for, I can't remember what we're talking about, but performances when it's like a two-hander and like one performance is really big and the other performance is more grounded and quiet, and like the Academy always gravitates toward the bigger of the two performances. And I used like Denzel in Training Day versus Ethan Hawke, what was the other one I used? Oh, Rain Man, like Dustin Hoffman versus Tom Cruise. And this is a great example. I was thinking too, I saw Bette Davis nominated, Joan Crawford, I think not nominated at all. So again, the Academy, they love to do that. Like, and Joan Crawford's good. She's good in the movie. She just has the way less showier performance than Bette Davis. You can't like out crazy Bette Davis in this movie. So does what she can. I felt bad. Joan Crawford apparently was pissed, I think, that she didn't get nominated and Bette Davis did. If I read that right. But
yes.
Like, it's a very, I don't know if fun's the right word. It's an entertaining movie for sure.
Oh yeah.
I don't want to do any spoilers, but I was like, I guess the twist at the end kind of surprised me with what happened with the, they show like a car accident early on. I was like, what? I'd forgotten about it because again, 3 days to watch it. So I was oh, right. Why'd they show that? And then it all kind of came back and I was like, oh yeah, I think they're both really good. They're just, one is a showy performance. One is, you know, not as showy. And Misery, maybe that's what you said, Misery. And like Kathy Bates, I think, won the Oscar, correct? I don't know if James Caan was even nominated.
No, he wasn't.
He's great. Every time. this is the Academy. I really enjoyed it. I'm so glad I got to finally watch it because it's been in my watch list forever. And yeah, I was like, I couldn't believe how crazy it was. Like, I just could not believe, like, and nearly a huge hit. So good for them, I guess. That was,
I guess if we decide to talk about the plot twist, then we'll do a big spoiler beforehand. Cause again, I don't know because of the age of the movie, how many people will have seen this, but wow. Like these characters are out of their minds because the level of hatred you have. But I think it does play consistent when we go back to the beginning. And I initially was distracted by the child acting was so-so in the first scenes there. But you see, you know, what young Blanche, her reaction to everything that's going on. It's like, yeah, she does not like her sister. And the fact that she goes to this extent to show that is really interesting. I think my favorite moments in Bette Davis's performance are when she is she's hired that piano player and she's trying to like sell this act where she's back and she's performing the same song she did when she was a little girl and how desperate that is, and that's very well done. The other moment I really liked is when the piano player shows up, and I think they both kind of feel that they're walking into some sort of not only a job but a potential romance, and they both look at each other, and for both actors there's this twinge of disappointment that they both have. It's like, oh yeah. This is not going to be somebody that's going to make me famous as, you know, as a piano player, and, you know, but I'm going to be humoring this lady. And then she's like, oh, this was, you know, this isn't some 21-year-old stud or something that's coming into, you know, that I can romance and, you know, throw money at it, that kind of thing. So, but the, it is interesting how that relationship unfolds too, in the second act, and later on there are some feelings that kind of develop there that are really interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of, and you can sort of see how it led to some of those really cool. I'm a sucker for 90s thrillers. Those 90s thrillers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Where there's these things happening. You know, like, oh, there's a way that our protagonist can get out of this situation and get help. But it doesn't work out, and we know it's not going to work out, to throw that message outside the window at one point, or that painful scene where she goes down the stairs because she has some time to get to a telephone and can't, you know, all the stuff where she can't communicate properly to the doctor what needs to happen. We know that those are not going to turn out that well because we're at minute 45 in the movie, not at the end here. But I still go along. I'm still in my, you know, My heart is in my throat while those things are happening. What is going to happen when Blanche gets discovered? I mean, that's great stuff. I mean, the suspense is there. I think it was a real formula for success. Carmelita, you're the one who I haven't let you speak yet about it. So
this gives me no. I wanted to hear you too, because I love it's one of my favorite things is the reactions of a first time viewer of a film that I've seen many times and love, and just to get that perspective of someone who's new to a film, their initial reactions is always one of my favorite things. So this was a joy to hear that both of you had not seen it and it was your first viewing, and to hear your impressions of it, because I love Baby Jane. I think it's, you know, it's psychological and it's tense and it's these insane performances, all those little choices. Betty Davis insisted on doing that makeup. That was all her.
I read that.
It's just, and when you later, you know, when the first time I saw this, I didn't know the whole backstory. When you find out the backstory of the tensions behind the scene between Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, it even just adds this whole other meta layer to the thing.
Oh my God, you feel it. I think in some scenes you feel that they do not like each other. It's like anti-chemistry. It's like, but it works. That's the movie. They're not supposed to be. It'd be worse if they were supposed to be like best friends and buddies, and they hate each other. But no, it completely just you feel the.
It works. It works. All that tension. I love. I mean, Matt, you're dead on. This movie is mean. These ladies are mean to each other.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, the whole thing, the psychological torture of Blanche when she goes to feed, or when she, her food is brought to her by Baby Jane.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's
that was the worst bit. I was creeped out by it. Like,
the fear of eating in your own home, of being afraid to eat. Like, that's intense. And it's all those little things in this film. You know, this is not a gory movie. It's not a bunch of jump scares. It's all that psychological stuff. That's very cool. It also, that opening, it always reminds me of the musical Gypsy, because there's similar dynamics there. Mm-hmm. Only in this film, there's this antagonism between the sisters, and, you know, the dynamic in the family that has spiraled into this lifelong toxic relationship, and seeing kind of those really messed up family dynamics play out throughout the lives of these women. And when we find them in this very desperate situation as, you know, aging, middle-aged women, it's great. I think it's very cool. It's almost got a gothic quality to it because of the house, because the mansion is falling down. It's just, it's a classic. I love it. It's got a camp element to it. So it is fun to watch, even though the things that are happening are, you know, I mean, when you see Baby Jane kicking Blanche on the ground, a woman that's who's brutal. In a wheelchair, yeah. I mean, that's really mean, but the camp element of this film makes it fun to watch regardless yeah. of that. Yeah. So I'm yeah. so happy you got to see it.
I mean, the violence for 1962, and I do really feel that, and it is suggested that, you know, this is the impact of Universal releasing Psycho 2 years before.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sure. sudden, Jack Warner, what kind of sold him on this idea was he needs to have his horror movie or his Psycho movie. And so that started, even though there's still kind of a safe decade, they were starting to push into what would later become the 70s, slowly but surely. I mean, a little bit in the language, but also in that level of violence, because we can, like, feel that violence, and I'm not sure that was always the case in, you know, I mean, the wars were violent, and there was a lot of gunplay and that kind of thing, but it was like slapping somebody across the face, not kicking somebody in a wheelchair. And, like, I mean, this is still, like, you know, a shocking amount of violence for 1962. Maybe if I show that to teenagers now, they'd be like, oh, what's a big deal? That's not that whatever. But as I get older and I'm just, like, kind of feeling for these characters, but should I be feeling for any of them? Should I be cheering for somebody over the other?
No, it still feels mean now. Like, it still feels so mean now. I think it's because it's their own sister and she's in a wheelchair. It's not yeah. like, it's no. not like a cop beating up like a criminal and like a noir. It's like her own sister beating her up and she's in a wheelchair and she's basically holding her captive and feeding her like rats and yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah.
So
it's like, and the bird was worse because that was her pet or whatever.
Yes, it was yes. her pet bird. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I let it go free. No, that's not what happened. You killed it in this plan. It's insidious.
Like calculated and against someone who's your family member. It just feels like it's so wild how like crazy this is, and people loved it. It was like a huge hit.
Enormous. Well. That led into Hush Hush being, you know, which was also a big hit. So, Matt, you are somebody I know from listening to the show that you care about justice. And
yes,
how do you make sense of this? As far as like, you know,
it's not really any justice in whatever happened to Baby Jane.
Nobody wins.
I guess that kind of makes it better, not better, but like. People aren't, it's not like Joan Crawford's super nice. I mean, she did try to hit her with a car, right? That was the, like, they're both bad and like no one's getting away with anything. If like, well, I guess spoilers, but Betty Davis, like if she drove off in the sunset at the end with like a bunch of money or something, I'd be like, oh, she got away. But the place where it's like, well, nothing good came of any of this, so I can't even be too upset. It's not like Joan Crawford was totally innocent and I was like, oh, this poor woman. I mean, I still feel bad for her, so it's kind of like poor woman, but I don't know, it just all kind of shakes out where it's like it's all terrible. You would think I'd be more upset as a Hound of Justice, but
Hound of Justice, that's the term I was trying to remember.
I'm gonna get it tattooed on my back at some point. I was kidding. My phone, okay, funny side story. My phone has started capitalizing the word justice, and I don't know why. Like when I go to text, it literally capitalizes justice, and I don't know why it's doing that. I was like, my phone knows.
They're listening. Like, they know.
Listening to your
that's true.
Podcasts, private conversations.
So I just thought it was funny. Today I was trying to text him about something, and I was like, justice is always capitalized. you forget about justice in this movie. I did. There was a lot of. I was earlier. You mentioned like. I felt I did see a lot of like 90s thriller DNA in this movie. And like just other, I felt like it felt influential to other things I'd seen later. So, I mean, it was very interesting to watch. I think I'd like it more on a second viewing when I don't watch it over 3 days and I'm not distracted. But I really enjoyed it. The performances are great. I don't know. It's a wild movie. So,
it's highly rewatchable.
I could believe that.
Yeah, I can see that, and I happily own a digital copy of it. So I know I'm going to rewatch it, and I think I'll get more out of it. I don't know, Matt, if you find this or Carmelita, when you're watching a movie and you don't have to analyze it for a podcast, it's just a different experience. So sometimes I go back and I'm like, I was so hard on this movie and I should have just, you know, why didn't I just relax and enjoy it? It's like, you feel like you have to, you know,
that's true.
That's kind of true.
Oh, I forgot to, I do own this now because the digital rental was $3.99 and the digital to buy was $4.99. So every time that happens, every single time I'm like, well, I'm going to buy what? That's a dollar. Like, of course I'm going to buy it. So I can watch
buy that for a dollar.
Yeah. Another film piece episode we did together. So I mean, every time they get me when they do that little like, it's like, oh, it's only a dollar more to buy it. Well, I guess I own this now. So I can watch it whenever I want now. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes me so happy.
Yeah. It'll be interesting because we now are going to put it against two underrated 70s movies and where it plays as far as points there. But it sounds like three thumbs up here. So, yeah. Okay. I think we're going to start off, Matt, your choice of an underrated 70s movie.
Okay, so I dug deep, I felt like, on this one. It's got like 500 votes on IMDb for ratings. It's a Canadian movie, which I didn't think about when I picked this. This is for you, for Canada.
Canada.
Listen, I did side story.
The country so well, this movie.
Oh yeah, this speaks so highly of Canadians. No, I thought you guys were so nice. So hold on, quick side story. I went to Disney World and went to Epcot and went to the Canada part, and they play the Canada movie.
Oh, that's hilarious.
The 360 that's movie. And they sell the shit out of Canada. I was like, I gotta go to Canada next week. Like, I need to go now. Like, beautiful, beautiful country. Except in a movie called Sudden Fury, when everyone's horrible.
Fred Bates was angry. He had tried to talk to his wife, reason with her, until that moment when she finally admitted she'd been unfaithful.
That guy practically forced me off the road a few miles back. He jumped right out in front of me.
Suddenly it happened. His world came crashing down. Help. And it was all her fault.
Help me, please.
But he was still alive, and she was close to death. All he had to do was give her time to die. They were miles from anyone. Please. Who would believe he hadn't tried to save her? Who would believe he had killed his wife in the heat of sudden fury? Fred had to cover up his crime. He couldn't let anyone find out what really happened. Surely they would take his word against the word of this stranger.
Help! Help! Why don't you just sit down and keep quiet? We've got a bit of a wait before the police get here. Laura!
The explosive story of an accident that turned into murder. A motion picture of intense drama and suspense. You will be held in the grip of tense excitement as one unexpected event follows another to a startling climax of sudden fury.
So Sudden Fury from 1975, directed and starring people I've never heard of before, but written by a man named Brian DeMude. I don't know how you pronounce that. DeMude.
Hey, Brian, DeMude, I think, yeah.
And basically, this man and this woman are driving through like a Canadian kind of countryside, not like in the city. He wants to buy some land. His wife has inheritance money he wants her to use. She doesn't want to. He knows she's having an affair. He brings that up when they're out driving. And he's like, that's why you give me the money. So then he drives them off the road, gets in a car accident. This random passerby stops and tries to help, and it spirals from there. that's the very long setup. There's like 45 minutes to get to that point, but that's the setup. So then the guy tries to help, and things go poorly after that. But very Hitchcockian in nature. Like, I feel like it's a very Hitchcock type plot, because it's just like random guy gets into some stuff that he, you know, just probably shouldn't be involved in. So Vinegar Syndrome put this out in Blu-ray. It's the only reason I've ever heard of it. I did an episode of Vinegar Syndrome movies like years ago with my friend Keith Rich, and we both picked it as a pick. We both like had this movie as like, go buy this from Vinegar Syndrome. It's really, really good. Super underrated, very under the radar. I think it is streaming places, but it's still clearly underrated. So that's a setup. I want to hear what you guys thought of Sudden Fury, because from what you said, I don't think either one of you had seen it before this.
No. Carmelita, you go ahead.
Okay, so this, just like it took you 3 days to get through Baby Jane, I went on there was a whole odyssey involved in watching Sudden Fury for the first time. So supposedly it was on Plex. I pull up Plex. It says the title, the year, the director, everything looks good. I start the film and there's Doogie Howser. And I'm like, what? But there's been construction going on at our house for the last few days, and my nerves are kind of frazzled and I haven't been sleeping well. And so I was kind of like letting it play out. I was like, this doesn't make sense. What's Doogie Howser doing here? And then
he's older, but he's not like, that old.
Right. And then I was like, wait, no, this can't be right. So then I go and I double check. No, it should be on here. And I close out of it and I go back into it. And I'm like, what? This is not the Sudden Fury I came for.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, okay, well, Plex is supposedly the only place this is streaming. So then I started to panic. Oh, no. I was able to track it down. So I was able to watch the film. it was an adventure. So yeah, I was not familiar with this, and reading the synopsis, I was like, okay, this sounds cool. And I was really interesting watching this, because and this is a very 70s thing, the protagonist of a film not being the good guy, not being the hero. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we're introduced to our protagonist, this husband whose wife is cheating on him, and they go on this road trip to visit friends, and it's like all of this marital strife is revealed. Mm-hmm. And the premise of this I thought was great. I thought the score was wonderful, like helping to ratchet up the tension, because I definitely, when they make their first stop on this trip for him to pitch to his wife, he needs her investment in his latest plan to become a successful entrepreneur. And she's standing on the edge of this ravine, and we're only a few minutes into the movie and I'm already like, oh girl, get away from the edge. I have a bad feeling. And so this movie is great at that. I think the Fred character, this husband,
mm-hmm.
his true colors are revealed to us so quickly, and he is so heinous. It's like, what is this movie? What are we watching? And I don't know. And I think there's a lot of exposition that comes through in the dialogue. And I think maybe with more nuanced performances, like, if you could dream cast this movie,
right,
like this could be like an all-timer, because there's like the story is so juicy, it's so meaty. This man taking this opportunity to solve his marital problem and roping all of these unwitting strangers into essentially playing a part. So I thought that all of that was really cool. And I don't know if it's because I was frazzled and like the stops and starts I had trying to watch the movie that I kept having to like rewind the first time I watched it because I was like miss things. And then I did end up watching it all the way through. So I think there's a lot of potential in this movie and I can see why someone would enjoy it. I think like it needed just like a little more polish or maybe a little more nuance. Like I would have loved it if that lead character, if we had not known for sure what an absolute creep he was. I think I would have really liked for them to have been a little more ambiguity. And it was kind of, it was interesting too. Like in some scenes, it seemed like this guy's kind of a bumbling idiot and he's unstable and he just makes these rash decisions. But then in other scenes, he's very manipulative and it seems like he's planned. Mm-hmm. He's like 10 steps ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
It was very interesting to watch this. I would watch it again. And I have a feeling if you catch me on a week where I'm not tired and frazzled, I would probably enjoy it more because there's a lot here. But that was my experience with Sudden Fury. Okay.
The way you were talking about it at first, I knew you were leading up to like it was very nice. You were like, yeah, this was good, like this some stuff that didn't quite work. So I figured that's where you were headed. But I'm glad it sounds like you liked it mostly overall. And I understand your like I don't criticize the right word, but like your points about it, because it's a bunch of like unknown Canadian actors, it seems like. I don't know any of these people.
Well, right. They did mostly TV.
Yeah.
Mostly there's TV. One... And even their TV credits are just a few.
Yeah. There's one guy near the end who's like the detective who I recognize from being in Tommy Boy, the Chris Farley movie.
That's right.
He's like one of the board members and one of the guys. I was like, I know that guy. And that's it. Everybody else, like, don't know who they are. It's if you could cast this with like a bunch of, you know, great 70s actors, then we're on a whole different level. But for what it is, I like what it is for a scrappy little production from Canada that, you know, is probably made for very little money. Sorry, Jason, let me cut you off.
No, that's all good. I mean, to the point that the two lead actors in this movie don't have pictures on IMDb.
So that's telling, yeah.
that's something there. Yeah, I did a really... And it was a similar type of thing. This is a hard movie to stream or to find. And there was this other Sudden Fury, but I was able to see that it was, I think, in the 90s or something. So I was like, well, that can't be that movie. And when I was looking up, I was like, well, that's not the same cast. Because I checked Tubi. Tubi had the other one. It was YouTube that saved the day for watching this.
Yes. It usually does save the day.
But weird commercial interruptions throughout.
Oh,
yeah. So it'd be, you know, it wasn't like at Tubi where there would be a logical point to have a commercial. So sometimes kind of mid-scene, one would show up for like this 5-second commercial, which would annoy me a bit. But that's not the movie's fault. I started off really not sure about this. And I will say consistently throughout the weak link is this Dominic Hogan who plays Fred. He's just so he's just not very good. Line delivery isn't right. He might as well be twitching his mustache through the whole thing because he is. We know right away that he is just a bad guy. And I kept thinking, okay, well, yeah, he's not going to grab the lunch that they're supposed to be. He's saying, oh, well, I'll grab the lunch, you go on ahead. And she goes and looks at this clip. I thought, he's going to shove her off and get, you know, insurance money, or that's what's going to be, what this is going to be about. And it wasn't, much to its credit. I mean, it turns into this rather nasty argument between the two of them. And then, you know, our Al, Dan Hennessy, who I think gives the, I thought the gay Ronan who was Janet, I think was very good too, as the wife at the beginning. And I think this guy who played Al was decent, and he carried enough of the film that that the one really kind of bad performance didn't spoil the meal for me, really. It started off as like a mini road rage, which was a little bit weird on that rather wide road. The fact that like he steps out of his car and that turns into like a big deal between the two of them. But then Al backs away and is like the bigger man because it looks like they're going to get into this fight after this other thing is happening. And I was like, oh, okay, is this entire movie just going to be chaos on the side of this road? And then we go to that scene at the gas station, and I really like that. And I thought, again, I have no idea where this movie is going. Is this like a gas station, like in, you know, The Hills Have Eyes or something like that? Before something that's going to be really, really.
Also, would have been interesting if it did.
It would have been. But yeah, I like the. I kept wondering when some of the confusion happens about who spoilers for the movie. The wife doesn't make it. Even though it seems like she dies about four times, but
it's true. I kept thinking she dead now. Oh no, she's still alive.
Oh,
it's
like they have another scene together. Okay, I see
that. It's like one of the henchmen in like fight. Austin Powers or something, where it's like they just
Al has this great conversation with the gas station attendant, and I like that scene, and it calms the movie down for a moment, and there's that nice moment again between Janet and Al is like, I'm sorry for my husband and all of that. I liked all of that. And then it got into, you know, yeah, the driving off the side of the road and surviving that rather massive car accident and then moving the body and into the car. But it really seemed that Fred was so, okay, I'm in this situation. I know exactly what to do. And he starts messing with Al's car. And like, okay, so what's he doing there? But then I saw him put it back, but nobody bothers to start the car again to see if it's still working so they can go and get some help. And it's like, oh, they missed opportunity there. And then we move into the farmhouse. And I like that sequence. I think the gas station attendant says, oh, there's this nice young couple that have a farm down there. When I saw, I had to wait a few scenes before I realized that this wasn't a father and daughter, that this was a husband and wife. That farmer looks, yes. Now that does happen in
yes.
rural Canadian places where there's an older man who marries this young, but she looks so much younger.
Yes, threw me for a loop 12. This time too. Yeah,
she really did.
I was like, this is a father-daughter or a grandfather-daughter. I was like, oh, with the husband and wife? Even, yeah. Oh, my God. It threw me for a loop.
Oh, they're married.
I'd forgotten. And I was like, wait, they're a married couple? It's like really, really messing me up. So I understand.
But I started off thinking this is going to be a rough watch. Once we got into, like, after all that, like, the time they took with all of these different steps, the cat and mouse game, the outthinking each other, and a little bit of, like, I like revenge movies. I really like revenge movies and 70s revenge movies in particular. Once we got into that part of it, I thought, this movie is so entertaining, such a great time. What a wonderful discovery. Thank you so much. I mean, I get why you picked it. And I really wasn't sure because this was a tough movie to see. And the first few scenes, because it was so much of this Fred character who just seemed like way too much. And even towards the end, like some of the games he's playing towards the end are massive overreactions. And when he's gloating, when it looks like he's the upper hand on Al towards the end. I never did like that performance. I didn't like the character, but I'm not supposed to like the character, but the performance was bad. But can a movie survive a bad lead performance? I think this one can. I don't know how it won me over, but I think you're going to be shocked when it comes to the points, how much I ended up enjoying this movie. It was strange. I mean, it was just like, it was like,
okay, good. I didn't. That was a journey you took me on. You both took me on journeys with this, where it's like you start thinking about it, and then how it ends up. I'm also very sorry. I didn't realize it became so hard to see. At one point, I could have sworn it was like on every free service under like Tubi.
It probably was.
And it now I look now, and yeah, it's only on Plex. So I apologize because it was.
But it's not on Plex, folks.
Oh, not even on. It's not even on Plex. It's yeah. It's happened to me before too.
No, it was Doogie.
Yeah. Doogie Howser. It's a different story, isn't it? It's not
like Doogie Howser's sudden fury. Yeah. I apologize. I thought it was like, oh, it'll be everywhere for free for them. It'd be so easy to see. And then I even checked.
YouTube came through. It's fine.
YouTube saved the day for me quite a few times.
It was worth it, though. I have to say it was worth it. And it made it even more rewarding when I got to the stuff I really enjoyed because I had to earn watching this movie. It was like the old days when that movie is not in the video store and I'm going to have to wait. I'm going to wait a few days for when it's returned so I can get it. I can't instantly gratify myself with this movie.
It's almost like the movie to me, it's almost like a tale of two movies. I feel like it's almost split down the middle where it's like,
yeah,
it's almost exactly halfway. Cause I had to stop this again, or I had to watch this in two halves. So I stopped it like right at the 45 minute mark. And that's right when like Fred, the husband, gets to the farm. And I feel like that becomes the back half of the movie and becomes kind of not a different movie, but it's a whole different section of the movie. And like the first half's interesting. I think it gets really interesting when they start having the argument in the car, the husband and the wife, because I feel like that argument feels organic to me, where it starts off like as one thing but becomes something else, where it's like, well, you're cheating on me. That he reveals he knows that to her, and it's like, oh shit. Because sometimes people start arguing one thing and then they turn into a whole other thing. It's like, are you really mad about being out of peanut butter, or are you having an affair? Like, what are you mad about?
Right.
Like, yeah, it's like it becomes okay. And then the accident happens and this guy Al gets involved, who is just a guy. He's just a guy. Normal guy, just a guy. And I do like that guy in the movie. I think he probably gives the best performance of anybody. Yes. It seems like he's genuine. Like he's not overly this angelic Samaritan. Like, it doesn't seem like he's like a perfect guy, you know, like he's just kind of like, shit, I'm really in a situation here. And all the stuff Fred that the husband does, like, seems, it's almost like half of it's luck and half of it's very devious, like messing with the car, messing with the phone at the farm. Then sometimes it's just like, it's like pure luck. Like what happens at the end when Al accidentally shoots a certain person. And it's kind of like, oh, well, now this looks bad for Al.
Spectacular. Wow.
I read somebody's review that said on Letterboxd, it was like, I saw this in a theater and like a Vinegar Syndrome screening. That moment, like, people just were stunned. I was shocked too, because I forgot it happened. I was like, oh shit. I think it's so scrappy. Like, I know this cost probably no money and stars nobody. So it's like they just went out and probably did this for, you know, very little money, probably over weekends, which makes it more impressive to me. Not a perfect movie, but if you'd asked me for like 90s underrated picks, I could have given you a bunch. But 70s was harder for me because I'm looking at stuff and I'm like, I'm farther from that decade, so I don't quite know what's really underrated or, you know, this or that. But this one I knew was underrated because so few people had logged it or seen it on IMDb. And I was like, well, this still seems like no one's seen it, even though it has this Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray. But I think now it's even out of print, so you can't even buy that. But I think it's a tight little thriller that just, like, you know, it works for what it is. After Carmelita said, though, if you had like top tier actors, that does make me wish that it was like populated with, like, you know, I don't know, pick three great 70s actors.
Michael Douglas is Fred, but Michael Douglas in the 1990s.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. And
I'm not big on remakes, but someone could remake this.
Very easily. Viggo Mortensen is Al.
I was thinking this has to be like a period piece of, like, because cell phones would ruin this whole thing.
I was thinking this
has to be set pre-cell phones, because this cell phones would throw the whole movie off. You know, I was thinking this is such a place in time, like, to be lost in like farmland country in the 70s. Like, you have very limited options. Like, it's just so different from how we live now. Like, you can't really, it's hard to get lost anymore. You know what I mean? Or you can't get contact with somebody. You got to be really, like, out of the way, you know. Right. So I was thinking about that. Well, the phone scene when he needs like the phone, I'm like, oh, this is just, you couldn't do this now. Like, yeah. But I mean, I, you know, I love it for what it is, and it feels very 70s too. Well, so it was like,
it's fascinating because I'm like, why is he doing this? Like, what is the advantage? But I see what he's doing after a while. Like, it kind of gets revealed. I was like, well, let's, you know, like, can't contact the the police or something, but I mean, how is that helping, when the farmer goes off and he like sends him off there and there's opportunities to get away, but then he comes back and, you know, this guy's smart. He's thinking through things and adapting to them, but yeah, they're both really intelligent in this game. I also think that, you know, the stock characters or the supporting characters are given a moment. Again, the young farmer's wife, she has some fight in her. It isn't like she's just there to be a lamb for the slaughter in this film. I mean, I think she has some really good scenes. And when she kind of clues in on what's happening, I mean, I think that works really well. I think if she's going to come running out of her room in a dangerous situation, she may or may not want to make a little bit of noise or something like that. So, but
I love that moment when she's like on the phone and sees like his shadow, like she already is nervous. Yeah. Then she like freaks out and falls back. That's a good moment. It's a good little thriller. And it's so funny because I was thinking like people don't even need names like this. You could be like the husband, the wife, the bystander, the farmer's wife, like because it's just that kind of story where it's just like a little, I don't know, thriller that just could have happened to anybody, I guess, if like the wrong person, wrong time type thing. But glad it sounds like you mostly both enjoyed it for the most part. Like, not a perfect movie, but
I'm really bashing the camera here. My thumb is up on this one, but
okay, good.
Yeah, Carmelita, since it's a little bit more mixed, but maybe you'll.
I'm a little more mixed, but I'm not sorry I watched it. It was fun to watch and just kind of marvel at some of the choices that these characters were making. Yeah. It's the kind of movie you could put on with a group of friends and heckle at the TV.
I think so.
Don't do that. Where are you going? No, get out of the car. You know, you could have a lot of fun watching this with a group of people and kind of really get into it.
Yeah, it's a real one of those like what would you do in the situation type movies. Yes, like what would you do if you were in Al's situation. But it's funny now, the whole thing about she was standing close to the edge of the mountain, like he would have saved himself a lot of time if he just like pushed her and then was like, oh, she
slipped. It would have been the easiest.
I guess they might investigate, but it's like what are how are they going to prove anything? It's like we went for a picnic or a walk and you know she slipped, she's very clumsy.
I was sure that's what he was going to do. And I was kind of glad that that's not what happened, because that would have been a bit too predictable. I mean, some things maybe are predictable here and there, but it's not really a totally predictable movie. I mean, I know we're going to be ending in violence towards the end, but it's still just because of the nature of the film that it is. But yeah, it's truly underrated and I think kind of a bit of a undiscovered film.
It's very hard to see. It sounds like I did not realize how it had fallen back to like being hard to see, so that doesn't help. So hopefully people will check it out.
Hopefully there'll be another way. Like I don't know how often Vinegar Syndrome will re-release something, or or when it's gone. I don't know.
I think usually when it's gone, it's gone, and then someone else has to pick it up.
Yeah,
like they lose the rights to put it out, and then like another.
And somebody will. There's so many boutique labels now.
Yeah, someone.
Somebody will. Yeah. And once something has been streaming before, it tends to come back at some point somewhere.
This will be like Kino Lorber will put this out or something. Probably Kino Lorber movie. Someone will probably pick it up at some point. So I mean, they sold out of Vinegar Syndrome, so the demand was there. It's not like it's still sitting there, however many years later. So,
I often talk about my fear of movies being lost. Sometimes I'll pick up some mediocre movie that lasted 1 week in theaters in 1995 because, well, if I have it here, then like somebody's going to remember it or somebody will discover it beyond my memory of when it was barely in theaters back then. So, I just hope this one, some people out there thinking about it. And so I'm happy to talk about it on this show. So Carmelita, I think it's time for your underrated 1970s.
Oh, you're welcome, gentlemen. So the film that I brought to the table is The Boys from Brazil.
History has shown how one man with a dream can turn the world into a nightmare. Can history repeat itself? The Boys from Brazil starts where that nightmare left off. But for the dream to live again, 94 men must die. Gregory Peck is the architect of that dream. Laurence Olivier is the man who must destroy it before it destroys the world.
He betrayed you! He betrayed the Aryan race!
Tell you who the boys from Brazil are, only that they are not science fiction.
30 years the world has forgotten, and you persist and persist.
You're not at guard now, madame. You're a prisoner.
The time is the present. The people exist. The threat is real.
Operation has been canceled.
No. Your operation has been canceled. I'm continuous.
Barry is dead.
Herr Liebermann.
Can decide if it's a dream or a nightmare. But be warned, if history can repeat itself, so can man.
A total of 94 assassinations.
Look for the boys from Brazil before they look for you.
From 1978, directed by Franklin J. Schaffner. Yes, Franklin J. Schaffner of Planet of the Apes and Patton. Screenplay by Haywood Gould of Rolling Thunder, Fort Apache, The Bronx, and Cocktail. Based on a book by Ira Levin. Cinematography by Henri Decay. This guy did Les Samurai and Elevator to the Gallows. The very prestigious. Yeah. And this part of why I picked this, the cast, this is insane. This is what I think makes this film underrated or underseen for the 70s. Because when you hear the cast, you say, you know, no one says Gregory Peck of The Boys from Brazil, but Gregory Peck stars in this movie. Laurence Olivier stars in this movie. James Mason stars in this movie. We also have Lily Palmer, Uta Hagen, Steve Guttenberg. There's a lot of people in this film. This is a big, heavy-hitting cast. And no one talks about it. So the premise of The Boys from Brazil is crazy. It is set in the present time of the 70s, 30 years after World War II. And this is a globetrotting movie. We spend some time in Paraguay. We spend some time in Austria, Switzerland, America, Canada. Because we're hunting Nazis, folks. There's a conspiracy. Dr. Joseph Mengele. Yes, Mengele. The eugenist, the Nazi eugenic doctor, played by Gregory Peck, has hatched this conspiracy to continue the work of the Third Reich. And Laurence Olivier, playing Ezra Lieberman, famous Nazi hunter, he's on the trail. Are we spoiling this? Should we spoil this?
I'm going to say right now, if this intrigues you, then watch.
Yeah. Just get out now. Movie. Go watch. Come back.
Listen to our conversation about it, because I don't see how we can review this without
and not talk about the crazy plan.
Yeah, because you've been
all right.
Recently warned. Okay.
So excited.
You've all been warned. The plot that Ezra Lieberman discovers is that Joseph Mengele has been working for 20 years on a project to clone Hitler. Right. They're cloning Hitler, folks. And all of these boys are aged 14 now. And as part of this process of producing the next Hitler, or many Hitlers, as it so happens, they've had to recreate Hitler's childhood family dynamics. And so thus, the fathers all have to die at the age of 65 when the boy is 14. And we meet some of these Hitler clones. This movie is crazy. It's crazy. I saw The Boys from Brazil as a kid.
Oh, my God.
This movie has been with me for most of my life.
Wow.
I, as a child, thought, you know, Gregory Peck, Lawrence, I knew those names were big names. And the way that this thing is shot, you can tell this is shot by a seasoned cinematographer and a director, and like the dialogue is good. And so as a kid, I mean, not really picking up on all the minutia of those elements, like I thought this must be one of those like big, heavy hitting famous movies. And over the course of my life realized, no, I don't know that a lot of people have seen this past, you know, whoever would have went to the movies at the time and got taken in by that cast. Like, it's not one that generations later people are still talking about. And when you say Laurence Olivier, pardon me, this isn't in the conversation. When they talk about the filmography of Gregory Peck, this is not in the conversation. And so I needed to talk about it with you.
Oh, boy.
So had you two seen this? You had not seen this?
No.
Never even heard of it before you brought it up.
Tell me everything.
I heard of it too, but I had not watched it. Yeah, go ahead. You can start us off.
Let's.
You need a moment though, because you're red with laughter. So.
Yeah, I think we're red this whole time. I don't know what's going on. It's hot, but I'm laughing. But let's go. Let's take this journey. So Carmelita says,
"Let's
watch The Boys from Brazil." Never heard that title in my life. Never heard of it. I thought, what is this movie like? Is it like Cocktail with Tom Cruise? Is it like a fun, like, boys, like, guys partying in the islands or something? No. Then I go to IMDb. And if you just read, like, the quick synopsis on IMDb and you don't dig any farther, because there's multiple ones, but on the front page it says, a Nazi hunter in Paraguay discovers a sinister and bizarre plot to rekindle the Third Reich. Cool, great. That could be anything. Like, that could be like,
sure,
he's just trying to recruit Nazis. I know the Nazis were into some weird shit, so I'm like, that is very open-ended. So I'm like, who knows? And then I'm like, Gregory Peck and Laurence Olivier, my God. I was like, what are we doing here? So I'm like, what is this movie? Then it really takes a turn. So I'm going, okay, where can I watch The Force in Brazil? It's on Peacock. Great, cool. I have Peacock. I go to Peacock. On Peacock, the synopsis, I open it up and it says, a former Nazi hunter finds a sinister doctor in the jungles of Paraguay in the process of cloning Hitler 95 times to create a band of leaders that will form the Fourth Reich. When
They spoiled it in the synopsis?
In the synopsis. Wow. It's okay. Wow. I wish I could have filmed my reaction to reading... reading the sentence cloning Hitler 95 times, and I was like, you need 95 Hitlers? And in my head I don't understand, like, that in my mind I'm imagining they're just cloning adult Hitlers. So I'm imagining I'm gonna see a movie with like 95 Hitlers all marching together, and I'm like, this sounds crazy. And I didn't realize it was like they're starting them from like babies and leaving them, the whole thing. I thought I was going to see an army of Hitlers marching toward, you know, Laurence Olivier. And I was like, what the fuck is this movie? Oh my God. So I'm like, at that point, I am jazzed. I'm like, start the movie. What is this going to be? And then Gutenberg comes in, like probably one of the first Steve Gutenberg movies. And I was like, is that Steve Gutenberg? And he's like his own mini movie to start the movie by himself and doing spy stuff. And then I'm like, oh my God, they're just like, it's such a complicated plan. It's like, let's clone Hitler. Let's leave all these Hitler babies with people. And we have to recreate the circumstances of Hitler. And I'm just like, this is so insane. And I'm like, why did Gregory Peck and Laurence Olivier sign up for this? Like, I don't know. I mean, because it's like, I mean this in the nicest way. It's like really high class trash, it feels like. Because it's like very pulpy, trashy idea that this is like a Grindhouse thing you'd hear about. Like, we're going to clone Hitler.
Totally.
They're both really going for it, especially Gregory Peck. Oh my God. It's like the Betty Davis performance of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, where he is into it. And it's freaking me out to see Gregory Peck doing Nazi stuff. I was like, oh, I don't like bad Gregory Peck. I think I read something that said like they were selling this on like, this was the first time he played like an actual like villain or like a real bad guy. I don't know. And he's really like scarily committed to the bit. Yes. Like it's like a little freaky. And then you'd see the Hitler clone boys, and I was like, what the fuck is happening? Like, this is the one, it's kind of similar to your viewing, I think, with Sudden Fury, Carmelita. Like, I was distracted watching this. There was a lot going on. I was like, well, this probably would have like killed like in a crowd at a theater because it's so crazy. Especially if you just like unleash it on people and don't tell them what you're really seeing. So I felt like my viewing was kind of hurt because I was not fully as into it as I would like to be, because like I should have been like just glued to the screen for how crazy this was. I liked it. It's never really boring, for sure. I don't even know what to say about it. It's so crazy it exists. That's what I kept thinking. Like, it's so crazy that this movie was made with these actors at this, and the quality, like the people you ran down, this high quality crew. It's just crazy. I don't even know what else to say, but I reading that synopsis on Peacock was one of the highlights of my week, because I just almost fell out of my chair. I was like, wait, 95? The fact they put 95 Hitlers was just like, that's a lot of Hitler.
What?
So crazy.
Funny to hear the parallels between your experiences when it comes to these movies. What was interesting in setting up just on the surface for this episode, I thought to myself, Sudden Fury might be a little bit overmatched with these, like, you know, kind of well-known, these, you know, polished studio films bookending it. And I had heard the title, but I knew nothing about this movie, and I watched it straight through. And when it opens, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Sorcerer. You know, if you have these little sequences here, or like William Friedkin would do things like this in the French as well. A lot of 70s movies would start off with these scenes, and they would be, you know, we're going between different countries and trying to establish what's going on. And then I saw Steve Gutenberg, and I thought, okay, well, maybe like this is before Three Men and a Baby and Police Academy, and he was 1980s Steve Gutenberg, and this is pretty good for him. He gets to be in a movie with Gregory Peck and Laurence Olivier. When we first see Laurence Olivier, and he's in that office, and everything is underwater and leaking, and there's all these overreactions and big accents, big dialects all over this movie. And I'm like, what's going on with these scenes feel kind of bad. And then we go back to Gutenberg and kind of, and I'm questioning again, he has this little kid who is, because he gives him this radio as a way that he's able to bug this rather high level meeting of these Nazis who have obviously escaped capture in, you know, the world. And he's able to tune in on this. And I kept thinking, was that whole sequence out of order? Was there a scene I was missing? When, like, how did that kid get up there to put the bug where it was? Okay, maybe I shouldn't be thinking that hard. But this is, you know, an Academy Award winning director, the director of Patton. and these great actors. And this is, for the record, an Academy Award nominated film.
It
is. In the categories of Best Film Editing, Best Original Score, and Best Actor, Laurence Olivier.
Oh, I did not know that.
Now, Gregory Peck comes in. My first note was, I think Gregory Peck has been miscast. And I have to say that that didn't change until even in the last scene when I was fully aware that, oh, I was taking this as like a serious kind of Nazi crime thriller film. But as things get unveiled and just beautifully photographed and everything professional, and I'm like, this movie is out of its mind. It is absolutely out of its mind. And if I had been better prepared, if I had read that synopsis about the 95 Hitlers, which would have spoiled a great surprise for me, I might have been less surprised by, in my view, how bad the acting is from this all-star cast of great actors. And I kept, when different people would pop up, I'd say, okay, well, this person is clearly giving, Denholm Elliott's barely in the movie, but when Denholm Elliott showed up, he's speaking in his own voice. He seems to be a character who's down to earth. I was like, okay, hopefully we're going to get lots of him because he seems to be the only one who's kind of getting the best takes out of the scenes in this movie. And Bruno Gantz comes in late in the film and like one of the, he's a bit of an exposition machine, unfortunately, but like he's an interesting actor. I just reviewed it's a Canadian movie for a Christopher Plummer show called Remember, which is another crazy movie about Nazis. With a crazy plot twist, but I've always liked that guy. I liked him in the Wim Wenders films and he played Hitler in Downfall. Perfectly. I really like that guy. So there's these moments. Anne Mira is in there. I always hate to use this, but I end up having to explain to people this is Ben Stiller's mother, but was she the Canadian or the American mother of one of the Hitlers too?
She's one of the mothers, because I had the same thing. Yeah. I was like, oh, it's Ben Stiller's mom, which I feel bad about because she did a lot of stuff. But I think it's the lady from Heavyweights, which is a 90s kids movie. Yeah.
I just saw, for the first time, I'll be talking about it in, probably by the time this is recorded, it will be out there, a movie called The Day Trippers, which I really love that entire movie and that ensemble cast. And she has this great role in there. So I'm always happy to see her in there. But it was these grounded performances I seemed to gravitate towards. I thought Olivier was, and he looks very subtle next to Gregory Peck and what Gregory Peck is doing. I mean, he's having a ball, maybe playing this villain. But I mean, he's in the Betty Davis territory here. But yes. He's making Betty Davis look subtle in Baby Jane, with this. Because I was like, I can get behind what she's doing. I may not be my favorite performance in the movie. It was just so bad. But I didn't realize I was watching a B movie dressed up as an A-plus Oscar for your consideration. And that's what I'm wrestling with here, to the point where I think this is the only one, sadly, where I think my thumb is down. Because I have a digital copy of it now. And so maybe revisiting it is going to happen, and I'll be like, I'll know what to expect. So then I'll be like, from the beginning, okay, they're taking an enormous swing for the fences here.
Yes.
And I should be applauding this swing for the fences. And I think that's why you picked this one. It's not a standard 1970s thriller. I'm not sure Olivier is giving a great performance though. I mean, he's going with that thick accent. It's sometimes difficult to make out his words. Again, for stage actor, diction is always important. But I feel like he got the character voice, and that's what he was playing, and that was his in with this particular role. He always needed an external. He wasn't a method acting guy. But it felt like there were a lot of people in here. I really like James Mason, but his Nazi accent too, which is perhaps maybe the most subtle of the Nazi accents that I was hearing, it still was pretty big and very actory. Like nobody seems really that grounded in this film, except for a couple characters in very, very supporting roles. I mean, Steve Guttenberg actually probably gives one of the better performances in this movie.
He seems very excited to be in a movie. Like, I don't know, he's excited to be there. Like, he has this like energy about him where he's just like, I'm on a spy mission, you know? And he's like, yeah, I guess he's like his own little mini movie at the beginning. Yeah. He's his own little spy movie with the kid. And of course, it does not end well. Really dark moment when Gregory Peck's like, kill the kid, basically. I was like, Jesus.
I was questioning about that, though. Like, he kind of smiles at the kid like a grandfatherly like figure, and then he says, kill the kid. But then we see the kid a few scenes later, and he's got like these Aryan blue eyes. Have they taken him and experimented on him, or was that a different kid?
Yes.
Yes, that's what they did.
Experimented on him.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't know what this has to do with the Hitler cloning program, but it was kind of a freaky moment there. So it's like they didn't.
This is the thing, right? This is Dr. Mengele.
Yeah. Yes.
This guy is evil. You know what I mean? Like
Nazis did all kinds of weird shit.
Exactly. And this is the thing about making a film post World War II about Nazis, is that you can do all this crazy over the top insanity. Because it's like, yeah, it's the Nazis. Yeah. Screw the Nazis. Yeah, those guys are crazy. So this movie, it is very pulpy. And as I was rewatching it with, you know, trying to be more analytical about it, because I've seen this movie many times throughout my life. It's one that I revisit periodically. But with that, like you talked about, you know, when we watch something for a podcast, we're looking at it from a different kind of lens because we're going to have to be analytical about it. It is very pulpy. And it's, I mean, very much so. Because it's got the elements of a pulp spy novel, of a pulp sci-fi novel. It's got like all those little elements to it that I think, it's just crazy. It is crazy. I think watching it this time, when I was a kid, I always kind of, my memory always went back to the end of this film. Because that final showdown.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It's insane. It's crazy. Gregory Peck playing this evil Nazi doctor who refuses to let this project be shut down. He's going to get his hands dirty and he's going to finish the work himself. And, you know, this unhinged quality of Gregory Peck's performance. And we haven't said, for anyone who...
Hello?
Say something.
How's that?
Hello? Quick, all improv. The thing you said really was spot on about it's a B movie dressed up as an A movie. That was throwing me off, where I'm like, it's got these actors that feel like A level actors. It's got this cast or crew that's like A level, and it's like it's a B movie, but it's dressed up as an A movie, and it's very like weird to. It's like it doesn't gel in my brain. Like that, this is such a pulpy, trashy movie with an A-level cast and crew.
I do want to address that climactic scene. Like I found it weird, is we have one of the Hitler clones at in this farm in Pennsylvania, and then we have this battle between Laurence Olivier and Gregory Peck. I'm supposed to believe in some moments in that scene that Laurence Olivier can out-muscle Gregory Peck. Like that fight scene was, I mean, I guess maybe I'm supposed to take my brain out at that point and
not
put it in this way, but you're just talking about the climax of the film and the idea of Laurence Olivier out-muscling Gregory Peck.
He's got that old man strength.
And then we've got those vicious dogs.
The Dobermans.
Oh, the dogs are scary.
The Hitler child. Again, not to pick on the child actor. We have the same guy, whether he has a British accent in the British sequence. He has, was there a German, a scene in Germany or something?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That kid wasn't the best actor, but anyway, I think he was most comfortable at playing this Pennsylvania farm.
Yeah.
He did seem better in that.
Bobby Wheelock.
Yeah. I think there was something strange about it, but not uninteresting. I mean, and so maybe again, just taking my first reaction out of here and just enjoying something that was so ridiculous and is not to be taken seriously. If I go with that attitude next time, I might have a better time with it. But because I thought I was watching, you know, like a serious
prestige movie,
and I didn't pick up on the science fiction until that scene with Bruno Gantz when it gets all revealed and it's like, and Olivier. Straight face is saying to him, I know what he's doing. I know what he's cloning.
Not Mozart.
Not Mozart.
Adolf Hitler. Like,
oh.
95 Hitler, like, I tell you.
Wow. I have a history teacher friend who despises Inglourious Basterds because he had students show up to him like right after that movie came out saying, oh, did you know that Hitler was killed in a movie theater in Paris and whatever? And he's like, what? Are you talking about? And then he went out to see that movie. And so he has a bit of a chip on his shoulder with Tarantino doing that and not making it super obvious what he was doing with, you know, the rewriting history for the revenge plot there. I think he would have an aneurysm watching this. If I talk to him, I'm going to, because to me, you know, I could get behind that. Oh, wow. Good for you, Quentin. But this, I was just,
oh yeah, I love the Inglourious Basterds thing because I understand history, and I just was like, "Oh, sweet justice."
See, I don't like Inglourious Basterds. The
Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah,
this one, because it's so pulp science fiction, because it's so out there, like in no realm of possibility did this happen. Like, this is clearly this crazy high concept. idea
until those kids show up and they go, do you know there's 95 Hitler clones running around in the world?
I know.
That's we should do something about this.
we're supposed to be feeling mighty creeped out, I think, in the last scene.
Yes.
I think the last scene's really effective. I think the last scene is good.
I knew it was coming though. It was going to be like,
sure. Oh, there's some Village of the Damned.
Yes.
Yeah.
Vibes that's about those kids.
Well, yeah. Somebody's review on Letterboxd was funny because it was just like, oh, it's a movie version of that question, like, would you go back and kill Hitler if you had a time machine as a baby type thing? And I'm like, oh, right. Now, listen, because the movie shows us that, I mean, that one kid, the one Hitler clone is already clearly going down a very dark path where they leave him. And me, Hound of Justice, I'm like, we got to kill all the Hitler clones. Like, sorry. Like, no question about it. Start taking them out. Like, there's no, like, sorry, kids.
That's a sequel that would have been great. I actually think I would have enjoyed that movie. You get another Nazi hunter going to find all of these little kids or those Hitlers.
You got like the Inglourious Bastards crew to hunt down, or like a crew like that to hunt down all the Hitler clones. Oh my God. I got to write this script. It's so good.
It's a crazy movie.
What happened to that other guy? Like he was the Gutenberg's friend who joined the team at one point.
Yeah. He was part of an organization.
That's right.
That was doing similar work.
Yeah.
And that Barry, Gutenberg's character, had left them, that group, to work alone, like his hero, Lieberman. Yeah. So that guy comes to help, and he's there at the end in the hospital room demanding that Lieberman give him the list of the clones.
He wanted to kill all of those clones.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's something interesting about that, like the choice that he makes to, you know, burn the list, and then they can't figure out who these Hitler clones are. And this Nazi hunter decides, oh, they could grow up to be fine young men or something. I guess that's what he's thinking. But I mean, he's encountered.
Well, I guess it's the question of possibility, right? It's justice. Yes. Are you guilty before you've actually committed a crime? Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep.
His point is, these are children. We don't know what they're going to, what their lives are going to be, what they're going to do. So I think Lieberman's point is, I'm not going to murder children.
Yeah,
whatever Mengele's plan was, these young human beings have not committed any crimes. And Lieberman, I'm not going to be like the Nazis.
Right. Yeah. It's...
and indiscriminately kill people.
Yeah.
And
I'm a person who believes in justice and.
Yeah. And this is my point with movies.
Morality and
ethics. I say, like, you know, in the real world, we got to go through trials and court systems. I understand that. In a movie, we have the God's eye view of what's happening. So when the movie leaves us with that one kid, I mean, and of course, it's one kid out of 95. So maybe they're not all this fucking insane, but like that kid's got to go. Like that kid is like that kid's not well. So it's like, I thought the movie's like telling us like they're all going to turn out like this. Maybe it's not saying that.
Well, and
but...
that's the question, right? This is something that I think this time around with that more analytical, I was thinking about how in some respects, like, yeah, the plan is crazy, but I do kind of appreciate they went a little further. A lot of sci-fi from this time period, like you clone someone and they're just you just create.
Right. Right.
A copy.
Which doesn't
of
make
this
sense.
Person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I kind of like how this one actually takes into consideration the whole nature nurture.
Yes. Yeah.
And part of the plan, as convoluted and crazy and complicated as it is,
yeah,
they took into account, like, oh, you would have to have the right conditions. The genetics is not enough. And that argument, I think, is something that didn't get made in a lot of films at that time about what is, how much of who we become is our upbringing, how much of it is our genetics, how much, you know, the blending of those two. Is it just your household? Is it also the conditions in your city, in your country, in the world? Like, what forms us? And I think the little seeds of that are in here in a way that they might not be in some other sci-fi films from that time.
But so the more reasonable plan is to go just remove these kids from these households and maybe put them with nice families or something, you know, it's like the Superman thing where like he lands in with nice people. And if he landed with evil people, God knows what would happen. So it's like, if you take all the little Hitler kids and just remove them from this condition, maybe they'll be okay. I don't know. I think it is more nurture versus, I think it's more nurture than nature. Honestly, I think like if you took two twins and put them in like a terrible household with racists and all kinds of, they would grow up completely different than people, a kid in a very nice household. I think it's like, you know, it's 100%, but I think it's mostly the conditions you grow up in. So the reasonable plot is to go just get these kids out of the system. Like, and hopefully we won't have 90 something Hitlers running around. I mean, which movie just been called 95 Hitlers? Like
95 so, Hitlers.
Take one down, pass it around. 94.
It's crazy. It's crazy. I'm so stoked you guys came on this journey.
I mean, I liked it. Again, I was distracted. I want to watch it again. But I think the highlight was reading the peacock description because my mind almost exploded.
That's the highlight for you. But this conversation has made me think that maybe I should like this movie more than my initial thought, because I'm
maybe not. I mean, your criticisms are fair.
But the age of the character, too, because you could remove them from these situations, put them in with different families, but some things will be ingrained now because of, I think they're 14, right? So,
right.
You know.
Oh, that's true.
Again, if you try to move a 14-year-old, a teenager, to another situation, I mean, I don't know that it's going to, you know, there's a lot. Life's not inevitable, but they are not going to be, it's going to be different than if they're 3 years old or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to avoid the murder, but I guess unleash the hounds for justice. I mean, these kids got to go.
This is another reason why I gravitate toward this film, is that I like movies where you like, afterwards you're like talking through like, oh, this and that, and like, what do you think about this? Like, I love that process, and this movie is ripe for that because it's just so out there.
I would love to show the people this movie cold, where they don't know anything about it. I would love that experience. Like, oh, it'd be so much fun. I had a rep like theater. I would just tell people to show up and I wouldn't even tell them the title. Be like, it's a mystery movie. I don't want them to Google anything and be like, we're watching this, and then just don't look anything up.
Leave your phones at the entrance, you know.
Yeah. We'll lock the phones up in those little bags. We'll be like, no one's getting their phone now. Like, oh, so it's very fun. I do feel like of the three movies, because I watched my movie last and rewatched it again. I was like, I feel like I brought a knife to a gunfight, because I feel like this is like, I feel like these are two like real crazy over the top movies with like big performances from big actors. And then I bring this little like Canadian with nobody in it.
What's a big performance? There is
we needed the balance.
Yeah.
Because actually both of the other films were Carmelita suggestions.
Yeah.
Oh right. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So we needed to balance out my energy with yours. Okay.
I just thought it was funny to watch both and watch my movie and be like, this is so much more low key than the other two movies. I just
which I think we kind of needed there. And the other, like when I was first kind of pitching this show to both of you, I also wanted you to be able to find a movie that you do a lot of podcasting. So a movie that you hadn't been able to talk about on before on other podcasts. So I don't know if you'd talked about Baby Jane before Carmelita, but for me, these were.
I have talked about Baby Jane before. Which is why I really wanted to hear from you guys more than myself, because that was what I was really looking forward to. But I'll talk about a movie a million times. I don't care.
You have told me that before. I'm always surprised by that. I think most people would be like, I talked about another podcast. I don't want to do it again. But I appreciate that you're like, I'll talk about it again.
I would talk about Baby Jane 50 times.
You could start your own podcast and then call it. What was the, they had the idea for the Conan podcast, constantly Conan Daniel.
Yes, Daniel Epler. He had this idea for me because I always want to watch Conan the Barbarian. I could start a podcast where we just talk about Conan the Barbarian and call it constantly Conan.
Every episode.
Oh, I love it. A new person. I think every episode she brings on a new guest. It's a good idea. I mean,
because I could talk about a movie that I love. I could talk about it a million times and never get tired. But
I really do feel like at one time in my life I thought I would watch a movie, I would have an opinion, and that would be the opinion that I'd have for the rest of my life. But as I revisit movies years later, or even sometimes if I watch something or I reviewed on more than one podcast and I see it again, I have a different experience with that. And I'm kind of like, okay, last time I was a little bit too hard, or last time I was a little bit too easy on this. Now I've got a reversal. That can happen a bit. So I'm curious if I get the chance to talk about any one of these on another show sometime, that would be kind of interesting.
I mean, highly unlikely that you will ever get asked to talk about The Boys from Brazil, which is a shame.
I hope people check it out, because I mean it's a real ride here. So are we ready to do some points?
Let's do it. Yeah, I think I know how this is going to be interesting.
This is going to be interesting. So again, since last time you were on, tried to simplify the points a little bit. So 3 points to your favorite, 2 to your kind of second favorite, and 1 to your least favorite. And with 3 people, it can be kind of unpredictable as well. So I am excited to see what happens here. I guess we'll maybe go with Matt. Well, maybe we'll do first.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever happened to Baby Jane? Whatever happened to the number of points that you're giving it?
You know what? I'm going to give that one the highest points. I'm going to give that one 3 points.
Okay. Then your choice, Sudden Fury.
I'm going to give that 2 points. So we're going to go straight down the line again.
So based on my math here, you know, or logic, whatever you call it, 1 for Boys from Brazil.
Yes. And again, I want to say I enjoyed it. I had a very distracted viewing. I would watch it again. And also knowing what I'm in for would make it a very different experience, because I just was so blindsided by that movie. But they were all good. This was not like there was a stinker in the bunch. I don't think there was no bad movie here. So yeah,
they're all fun.
That's yes.
Imagine this for a moment. Sorry, just I keep coming with wild ideas. Robert Rodriguez directing 95 Hitlers attacking Laurence Olivier. Wouldn't that be?
Someone needs to make a Grindhouse trailer for like this, where it's like, yeah, they went to Paraguay to clone 95 Hitlers, and it's like, yes, and there's only one man that can stop them, Nazi Hunter, whatever. And it's like, that's a B movie that somebody should have made. And I
like Snarling
see,
Dobermans.
Yeah, yeah. Snarling, yes, Dobermans. I want to see like legit 95 adult like Hitler clones, like, yeah, attacking, and then like a group of guys like Inglourious Basterds like shooting all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Make that movie, Hollywood. Let's go.
Robert, we need you.
Come back, yeah, after he needs, whatever that last movie I didn't like that he made.
Back in his lane, you know.
He's got to get back in his lane after Hypnotic. That movie was,
yeah,
not.
I went in with no expectations, and I think I had a better time than most people with Hypnotic. But it was
okay.
It's
yeah.
That's a.
I paid to see it in the theater because Robert Rodriguez is one of my guys. But
yeah,
I thought it was.
Yeah, well, just keep supporting him. He'll come back.
Come back eventually.
So Carmelita, whatever happened to Baby Jane? How many points?
3 points.
3 points. All right. Sudden Fury.
1 point.
And Boys from Brazil.
2 points. You knew that was coming.
I knew that one was coming, but yeah. Thought I didn't need to review the fact that I would have been able to.
Jason's a mysterious one. I don't know.
No, I think I know where this is going.
I probably know where it's going. I'm
Carmelita is pretty good at reading me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this was not, again, this is not what I expected, you know, when all was done, but, you know.
Here we are.
What happened to Baby Jane? 2 points. Oh. Much to my surprise, and after the first 5 minutes, I wasn't sure, but Sudden Fury is my favorite of these three with 3 points.
Shocked. I love this.
And
it's the Canadian connection.
I don't, Canadians.
Spoke to you.
The Boys from Brazil, sadly, 1 point. I thought,
okay,
on the surface, Boys from Brazil might have been winner. And Hush Hush was a bit of a mixed experience for me going in. But this conversation about the Boys from Brazil was so much fun and so entertaining that,
yeah,
I promise you that if the opportunity presents itself, I will give it another day in court. But I had to kind of go with my heart, obviously.
No, that's fair. And that's enough for me. I don't know if
anybody else would pick Sudden Fury as the top one among these three. But wow, at the
fantastic
end, I was like, I went to the movies for the last hour and a half. And I just feel good about this. And that, again, that odd scene with the, you know, the police officer talking at the end. Like,
yeah,
is this the end of the movie? Yeah, kind of. We're left, you know, there's some questions. But I'm fine with having those questions not resolved. Like what happens in a lesser movie, we would go on for another half an hour and
right, yeah,
straight to the point there. So based on our three, the winner would be Whatever Happened to Baby Jane with 8 points.
Hooray!
Second place would be Sudden Fury. If I had a physical copy of it, The Boys from Brazil would have to leave my collection because it got 4 points. Again, not a bad showing, just 2 points behind Sudden Fury. So between the two of you now, knowing I have a digital copy, and again, as I say at the end of these situations, I'm not smart enough to know how to get rid of a digital copy from my collection. What should I do then as kind of a wrap-up to this episode?
You know what I think you should have to do?
Oh, I'm curious.
I think you should have to watch it again. But this time you need to rope in someone who doesn't know what it's about.
I think I can do that. I think I can do that. Yeah.
I think that's fun. That's just my suggestion. What do you think, Matt?
Matt.
Oh, I don't. I was torn. I was like, what do you do? Like, hack the mainframe and delete the, delete the digital copy? I don't know.
There's probably some way to do that. I know there is, because there's some digital movies I'd have to get rid of then, because we run into this a lot of Carmelita's episodes. I think there's been the odd one where I've actually had the physical copy, but yeah.
I don't know. I want you to get a physical copy of Sudden Fury if you don't have one already, but I think they're expensive.
Well, I can't find it. There might be ones kind of internationally I can get, but yeah, that's not that would be great.
I am sorry.
I mean, you would try to do that anyway.
Yeah. We have to go with Carmelita's idea, because I'm blanking. I got nothing. I'm sorry. I should have prepared better. I apologize.
Well, you never know which movie is going to go in, like how to handle the situation there. So yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I was happy that in this case, it wasn't the Hagsploitation movie that was at the bottom of the list. So
me too.
Very entertaining movie. Would I think still play well if you forced a bunch of like younger people to watch that. I think they'd be very entertained because it's just so. Out of it,
I think. Yeah.
It's like pitched at a crazy level. Like it's so wild that I think it would just blow away any expectations I had of that movie. Because I did really, I want to watch it again. I'm glad I own it digitally now because when you break a movie up over 3 days, that is not the optimal way to watch a movie. No. But even that, it still played really well. So I was like, this might have been like a 4.5 star movie if I had just watched it in one undistracted sitting. So yeah, I'm glad you finally pushed me to watch that movie. It was, and Boris in Brazil is just, I'll never stop thinking about that premise.
No, no. Like, it's a memorable
that's a gift.
Yeah, it's not going to leave me. I mean, it really
I will not forget it.
You'll never forget.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, on my deathbed. There were clone 95 Hitlers. 95 what, Grandpa? 95
Hitlers.
He just kept saying 95 Hitlers, and then he died.
This is his last words. And what does that mean?
What did it mean?
This is type of
honesty. Was he warning us of something? Quick, someone Google 95 Hitlers.
It was the late 70s, so something would have happened. Did any of those 95 Hitlers go into real estate in New York sometime in the 80s? I'm just wondering.
Oh. Now imagine a scenario where like some of the Hitlers like became very like normal guys, like you know, like you just, I imagine like a real estate agent Hitler who's just like living his life.
Oh, for sure.
And then
sure,
they come,
yeah,
they come to assassinate him, and he's like, "What? Like I didn't do anything."
It's like, "What? What did I do?
What did I do?
Oh,
your God. DNA. You must die."
It's so crazy. I just love it. So I
mean, it's funny because
like,
it was
my... with the dog. Like it, the dog does the killing too because of the dog.
Oh yeah. It's funny because it's I put amazing. It on my bottom of the ranking technically, but it may have been the most fun to talk about. So
that's what I hope.
Yeah.
That was my hope.
Yeah.
It was a weird bunch. I mean, like these are not, you know, one's more
than
the
other two,
but it just
interesting experience watching them. Plenty of interesting things to talk about. So thank you, gentlemen. This was a blast.
It would be great if I and sometimes I in my fantasy world I own a movie theater and I would put on retro screens like this. That would be an amazing triple. Like, you know,
settle
in tonight and watch these three. You will know that you have been to the movies that night for sure. So.
Yes. Big performances.
That's all I think about doing if I was super rich, is to get a rep theater and play whatever I wanted and not worry if we're losing money. Like, that's what I would do.
I know, like, there's two possibilities here in the province of Saskatchewan where I live. There's this one movie theater that's up north that is still there. It's always for sale, but they, you know, and they could be playing midnight movies, and there's all kinds of kids there that I know would go to it. And then one of our theaters is up for sale here. We don't have many left in our city, unfortunately. Again, if I was independently wealthy, I'd buy it and keep it going. And, you know, I just love that idea of, I always think of these great midnight movies and, you know, with the lack of drive-ins and all these other things, these movies kind of get lost in a big screen experience. I think they'd be a lot of fun there. So tell me, you know, what's happening with Film Feast here. I mention it at the end of every show. I want people to listen to the podcast there, but where we're at, I know I'm probably the last episode to give you an idea of where I've left off, and I'm starting a new one tomorrow there, but The Book of Eli was the last episode I listened to. A very, very entertaining show that one was. Yeah.
That was a couple good guests on that one. That was a good episode. Weird mixed feelings about that movie now, but I still really like it. But I gotta get, God, when was that? See, this is what happens when you podcast like every week. You forget when things happen. A Carmelita episode's up next for you because it's Predator with Carmelita and Andy Gorham.
That's fun.
Oh, that'd be a good one. Yeah.
So you're not that far behind. And then there should be, so what's coming up, if this is coming out like relatively soon, I think I'm doing an episode on like Shaun of the Dead with the guys, like the gang of like Andy Gorham and James Coddington and Chris Barreras again. And Carmelita's going to be back on soon with our friend Larry Sternshine to talk, like we're doing a like 90s marathon, or 94, I'm sorry, not 90s, like a 94 marathon. Because it's the 30th anniversary of 1994, which is crazy. crazy.
I remember that summer when Pulp Fiction was all a buzz after Con, and like everybody was talking about it in summer holidays. I was like, I want to see this movie. 94 was such a great year for films.
It's a really good year for movies. Like at first I tell you this, Carmelie, but I was like, can we do a Marathon 94? But there's so many options. I'm like, we'll be fine. Some years you don't, but 94 is a great year. Then after that, I don't really know, but we did start a new series recently on John Carpenter movies because our friend Daniel Epler was doing a series on Tronker called Master Carpenter. But he's doing so great on YouTube. He is just doing the YouTube now, his YouTube channel, and has kind of left the podcast, but he very kindly let me take over the Master Carpenter series. So I'll be doing that once a month, a Carpenter movie. And we started where he left off. We started with Starman, which just came out. So that's going to be fun. So lots of good stuff. I've been pretty consistent with the weekly episode. That was funny when you were like, I'm so consistent. I'm thinking back to like the fall and took like a 2 month break. But
Lindsay is interrupted. You do an October run.
I know. That's everyone. The running joke was like, Matt, did you even take a break? Because I came back with Carmelita actually for the Blade and Blade 2 episode because it was like the anniversary of the podcast. Mm-hmm. I was like, I had to sign for that. And then I had an October episode and then I was back in November. So I guess
you're doing the top 10 shows. And then,
it didn't feel like a break to anybody, but I felt refreshed. So it was a good break for me. But Lindsay, that's what mattered. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lindsay is the one who like does not, I think, miss a week, is like so like scheduled and like is so on her shit. And I'm over here like flailing every week for an episode. And like Lindsay has them banked. Like she's ready. She is a podcasting machine. But I am trying to better be consistent. I've been pretty good lately. So anyway, I thank you for all the kind words and everything. I appreciate it.
Yeah, there have been points where like I don't know how Matt's doing it because I'm struggling at times to kind of get the number of shows. I've been very fortunate so far. 2024 has been a really good year for getting shows, and I started all of these other ones, solo shows. I started this vinegar syndrome thing because I talked to you and I got that subscription and I was I'm going to do a show for each month of the movies that I get, but now I'm already behind. So I'm doing the watching for the February ones. And
that's a commitment to be like, I'm going to watch all these movies I get and then talk about them. Like that's tough. So I wouldn't give you too much hard time about that. So just do it as you can do it. That's a lot to do. So
yeah. But I'd rather have this where I have lots of episodes and lots of ideas
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, when life gets in the way and I haven't recorded as many, I really enjoy it. I mean, I just it's so much fun talking to folks like you, and I know I'll be kind of riding high for the rest of the day here. So I appreciate your time on this, and hopefully you will both separately and maybe again like together we'll come back on the show here, and
I'd love it anytime.
I always have ideas, and like you both have great ideas as well too. So I also want to mention again some other friends of the podcast. So of course Rank and Review, my friend Larry's show, and then of course Schlock and Awe. We've been talking about Lindsay, and I can't believe how many shows she produces. It's unbelievable too. And then my friend Kirk Fitzpatrick's show, A Lifetime of Hallmark, reviewing Hallmark and Lifetime movies in a very comedic and fun way. So please support those local podcasts. And nobody's making money at this. We just really enjoy talking about what we want to talk about. And it's fun. I've been fortunate to have a few people who have loved film in my life, but some people don't always have that person, the true movie nerd that you could talk to about this stuff. And so it's been great. And I think it was actually, we'll get Carmelita. We lost her for a moment here. We'll get her back on here. But it was interesting. But what led me to talk to Carmelita and ask her to be on the show was when I first heard you two do the Mandy episode. And that's what led me to reach out to Carmelita and say, you don't know me at all, another random Canadian. And I did the same thing to you, Matt, as well. It was like, you sound like nice people to talk to. So, maybe, and worst case, they say no. And they, that's all good. So, yeah. So thank you for being on the show multiple times here. And my last bit, as I usually say, just to those listening, be kind, be healthy, you know, and I just kind of wish the best for everybody. And please, please, please keep supporting the movies, because they are a worthwhile art form. In a world that's so kind of chaotic and dark sometimes, I just find the movies are a lot of fun. And talking about them really enriches that experience. So until next time, thank you for listening. Goodbye.